At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
What Brexit means for sports, why presidential candidates don't want your money, and the economics of the super team. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 4th of July, Independence Day. Here in the U.S., independence from Great Britain, which, as you know, has recently voted for its own independence from the European Union. The more things change. The fireworks there nowhere near over, though these big seismic moves are messy. They create uncertainty, displacement, backlash, even violence. It's especially acute right now for the 3 million migrants from EU countries who are living in Britain. A Brexit could potentially end the automatic right of EU nationals to settle in the UK, and it's unclear what'll happen to the migrants who are there now. Joining us from London is Marketplace's Stephen Beard. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Molly.
So what will happen to these EU migrants now after Brexit? They won't be deported, or maybe they will?
None of the Brexit leaders called for that during the referendum campaign. Mm-hmm. This was, after all, about, as they put it, taking back control of Britain's governance, including its borders, and reducing the future flow of immigrants into the UK, which has been running at record levels for the past decade. Nevertheless, the campaign and the result have stirred up quite a lot of hostility towards the migrants already here. Listen to these two Leave voters from the north of England.
Get rid of the half of them that's in the country now. They don't belong here.
It should be the people that's born here gets to stay, but the people that are coming in now shouldn't. They should be deported back out.
Hmm. And the police have reported there's been an upsurge in xenophobic and racist abuse and graffiti aimed mostly at EU nationals, but in some cases at British citizens of Asian or African descent. They've been targeted too.
Right. And how are EU migrants reacting? I imagine it's not a comfortable environment.
No. Since the referendum result, I've spoken to about 20 or so EU nationals living here. And they are in shock. Dina Sidorska, a Latvian who's been here for 6 years and is now studying for a biology doctorate, she's feeling alienated.
I'm not so sure that this place is as much a home for me as it was day before the referendum. It feels like a lot of people have seen this vote as okay for them to express how much they actually dislike people like me.
Foreigners.
Yes, foreigners.
And so now what happens? I mean, it seems like this is going to be a long process, assuming that Brexit happens. It'll be a long run-up, right? 2 years? What happens to these nationals in the meantime?
Well, that is indeed what many of them are worried about. And one of them organized a national workplace protest today. He called on the 2.1 million EU nationals who are working in the UK to demand that the government pass immediate legislation protecting their rights of residence here to stay if they want to stay. Here's Christoph Deák, the Hungarian, who organized today's workplace protest.
Many of us who have been here contributing to UK society, paying taxes and all that, we deserve to have a certain future ahead of us, and we would like to get guarantees up front that our future can be certain in the UK.
And so could there be these guarantees? Will they happen? And what might that look like?
Well, if public opinion had anything to do with it, yes, there would be. According to the latest opinion survey, 84% of the British people said the EU migrants already here should not be asked to leave. two prominent Brexiters who are vying for the job of Prime Minister now that David Cameron is stepping down, both said today that there should be a guarantee for the migrants already here. But the front runner in that campaign, Theresa May, has said, as part of the Brexit negotiations, we'll need to look at this issue. That raises the prospect of 3 million EU nationals in Britain becoming bargaining chips in the Brexit negotiations.
What if many of these migrants do end up leaving?
That could be very problematic for the UK, and not just if the skilled and highly educated ones leave. Up to a third of jobs in food manufacturing here are filled by low-paid EU migrant workers. If they went en masse, that would have big implications for food prices. The shockwaves from Brexit could reverberate for years.
That's Stephen Beard reporting for Marketplace in London. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you, Molly.
A little more on Brexit before we move on. We've spent a lot of the last week and a half talking about a potential exit could affect global economics. But what about one specific industry where employees move from country to country and contract to contract at a moment's notice? Of course, we're talking about sports. Marketplace's Andy Euler takes a look.
Any industry that crosses international borders to do business is going to be affected by the currency market. Sport is no different.
Worldwide, sports is about a $150 billion business.
Matthew Futterman is author of the book Players, the story of sports and money and the visionaries who fought to create a revolution.
Any business that's that big is going to be affected by the sort of macroeconomic earthquakes that happen.
Stefan Szymański is professor of sports management at the University of Michigan. He says organizations like the English Premier League and FIFA might actually benefit from turmoil in the currency markets.
Think about these institutions really as being exporters. They're exporters of sporting products to the rest of the world. If you're an exporter, you actually benefit when your currency is depreciating because that just makes it look cheaper.
But it's a little different for individuals. The Wimbledon Tennis Grand Slam wraps up this weekend. The men's and women's champions will make £2 million, the most in the tournament's history. And in dollars, that's about $300,000 less than it was 2 weeks ago. But even teams and players closer to home have to deal with currency shifts. Victor Matheson teaches economics at the College of the Holy Cross. He says we see this all the time in the National Hockey League, where 7 of the 30 teams are based in Canada.
In the NHL, all players, no matter where you play, are paid in American dollars, which means if you're a Canadian team and the Canadian dollar's weak, you have a hard time signing those pricey free agents.
And it shows. Not to blame the currency markets, but it's been 23 years since a Canadian team won the Stanley Cup. Man, loony. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
U.S. markets closed because of the July 4th holiday. U.K. stocks dropped, although the pound is starting to stabilize. That and more details when we do the numbers. Okay, speaking of loonies, I'm talking about money, you guys, the money. A loony is the Canadian $1 coin. That's your pub trivia answer for the day. So speaking of money, when it comes to campaign cash, the presidential candidates practically live by this motto: there's no such thing as too much. But there was a time when Americans tried to rein in the never-ending fundraising that has come to characterize our politics. Maybe you remember that little box you can check on your tax forms. That's the one that allocates a few dollars to public financing for our elections. It's still there, but nowadays most candidates don't even want the money. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains why.
FYI, checking that box doesn't increase your taxes. It just allocates $3 to the campaign fund, which now has more than $300 million sitting in it. But the major party candidates say no thanks. Eleanor Neff Powell teaches political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Well, in the current cycle, the only candidate who's taking it who's still in the race is the Green Party nominee Jill Stein.
Clinton and Trump don't want the cash because it comes with strings attached, like no more fundraising once you get the money, and, here's the big one, agreeing to spending limits in the general election of about $100 million.
And just to put that into context, last time around, Obama spent around $775 million. Romney spent around $460 million. So this would be a much lower level of spending.
It used to be that everyone used the system. And Thomas Mann, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, says it made the campaigns better.
It worked well for about six elections. Its first was 1976.
But it all started to unravel in the early 2000s. And in 2008, then-candidate Barack Obama rang the death knell.
We've made the decision not to participate in the public financing system for the general election.
Since then, no major party nominee has taken the money. So it was nice while it lasted, Mann says. But
we're now at the point where it's absolutely irrelevant to presidential elections.
Taxpayers seem to agree. Remember that box on your tax form? The one that directs money to public financing? Back in 1980, more than a quarter of us checked it. Last year, it was down to about 5%. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Holiday weekends in America often include a family trip to some big attraction, theme parks, state fairs, maybe even the circus. Remember that? When you used to go to the circus? Yeah, no, it's not what it used to be. Earlier this summer, New York's Big Apple Circus put on its last performance of the season. The performers are hoping it's not the last performance ever. There are only about a dozen circus companies in the country today compared to a couple hundred 40 years ago. Tastes change, priorities change, and everyone from audiences to sponsors are putting on the disappearing act. Ashley Mildtight has more.
It's been at least a century since circuses were in their heyday. Peter Schrake is the archivist of Circus World Museum in Baraboo, Wisconsin. He says whole towns used to flock to the big tent, and not just for entertainment.
You saw new technology on display, sometimes the first time people saw a light bulb or a motion picture or the newest automobile or news from, like, say, the Spanish-American War was with a traveling circus.
Then came radio, TV, and the internet. Will Maitland-Weiss is executive director of the nonprofit Big Apple Circus. It's just launched a crowdfunding campaign. He says the audience has plateaued and the costs of touring have shot up. Before the financial crisis,
we used to make about $2 million a year in revenue from corporations who would buy out the house. And they would use it as a way of entertaining clients or rewarding employees and their families.
He says that number has dropped by half. Still, plenty of people still train as circus performers. Susie Winson is the director of a circus school in New York called Circus Warehouse.
People are using circus arts in things other than the circus.
She says a lot of her students
do nightclub work, they do corporate events, they do private parties. This is actually where the money is.
Not to mention on Broadway and in Hollywood. And she says, like a lot of other workers, circus performers can't just be a juggler or a trapeze artist anymore. They have to be good at everything. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there was this assumption that black families could get along with less and white families needed a little more.
The historical discrimination in the welfare system. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed today, of course, for the Independence Day holiday. In Europe, markets slipped. Britain's FTSE declined 0.8%, or 55 points, to close at 65.22. Germany's DAX slid 0.7, 67 points, to 97.09. France's CAC 40 was off 0.9%, 39 points, and finished at 42.34. Asian markets had a stronger day in Tokyo. The Nikkei rose 0.6, 93 points, to close at 15,775. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. 20 years ago this August, welfare reform was signed into law. That's when the federal government overhauled the cash assistance program for poor families and put in a new system known as temporary assistance for needy families. And that is the focus of our new podcast from the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk. It's called The Uncertain Hour, and it asks this question. 20 years after we ended welfare as we know it, what do we actually know about it? Today, Marketplace's senior correspondent Chrissy Clark gets some historical perspective.
My name is Ruby Duncan.
And how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, that's no problem. I tell that all the time. I'm 83 at the moment.
Ruby has a big smile and looks you straight in the eye when she talks to you. Like, she wants to make sure you understand exactly what she thinks before she moves on. She gets around mostly in a wheelchair now, but she's spent most of her life on her feet, picking cotton, cleaning houses. She's been a hotel maid, a barmaid. Back in the late 60s, she worked at the Sahara Casino in Las Vegas, in one of the kitchens there, prepping food for thousands of people a day.
1,200 salads made in a hurry, 160 gallons of coffee. So I was pretty swift. I did a great job.
One morning, Ruby was in the middle of her regular routine, racing back and forth from the pantry to her station in the kitchen, balancing a platter loaded with food, when...
As I was coming back, I slipped.
On some cooking oil that had spilled. She fell hard.
And I didn't know at the moment what had really happened. They helped me up.
It turned out she'd done severe damage to her spine. She was in and out of the hospital for more than a year.
2 knee replacements, a hip replacement, 4 back surgeries. I really messed myself up.
The injuries made it impossible to be on her feet all day, working a kitchen job, or pretty much any other job she could find at the time, as a woman who'd never finished high school. While her union and her employer battled it out over whether to pay her disability, she tried to figure out how, with no current income, to support her 7 kids on her own. Her children's fathers were out of the picture.
So therefore, I've become a welfare recipient.
You can still hear in her voice how uncomfortable she felt about this new label after having worked since she was 8 years old. But she would be a welfare recipient on and off for years as her kids grew up, working a little, then going back on welfare when the pain from her injury would get too bad. And she hated it.
I hated welfare, to be fair with you. I really hated it. You're talked down to and you really are completely always stressed out.
And Ruby's stress and her hatred of the system only increased when she learned something one day as she was doing her grocery shopping.
What happened was on the first of the month, the stores are crowded.
The first of the month being the day when families usually got their welfare checks.
And you can tell who the welfare recipients were because the carts begin to start filling up as much as possible. And so women began to talk to each other, and we would talk about, you know, as we conversating, we would say, well, how much do you get, and how large are your family?
Turns out the white women she talked to were getting more welfare benefits
than the black welfare mothers.
I'll get back to Ruby's story soon. But let me just step back for a moment to put it in some context. Because the thing you need to know about Ruby's discovery is that it was not unique. It wasn't just a fluke about the women she talked to in that grocery store in Las Vegas. For many decades, dating back to its inception in the 1930s, discrimination in the welfare system was a defining fact of the welfare system. It was written into guidelines at various welfare offices across the country, including the one where a woman named Nancy Humphreys worked in Los Angeles. She later became a professor of social work, but back in the 1960s...
I worked as an intake worker for the first year of my employment.
And Nancy says some of the forms she had to fill out when she signed families up for welfare were based on these discriminatory rules.
I saw them. I wrote them out. I complained about doing it. I said, this isn't right. And they said, those are the rules. You looked on a chart, and if a mother was applying for herself and 3 children, there was a white column and a black column. It was just the way the rules were set up. There was this assumption that black families could get along with less and white families needed a little more.
You know, it's interesting. There was really only a tiny trickle of African Americans on the rolls for a long time.
Kathy Eden is a professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins. She's been studying the welfare system for most of her career. And she says up through the end of the 60s, states didn't just give black families fewer benefits than white families. They also made it harder for them to get welfare benefits in the first place.
States had clever ways of keeping blacks off the rolls.
Part of it was the kinds of things that you had to talk about.
Here's Nancy Humphreys again, who worked in the LA Welfare Office. She says they were told to ask invasive questions that discouraged women from applying for welfare.
You had to ask people about how often they had sex.
You would ask that?
Yes, you were supposed to find out how often they had had sex and over what period of time.
Another tactic to keep Black families off the rolls, sociologist Kathy Eden says, was something called the good housekeeping test.
In which caseworkers would literally don white gloves and come into your dwelling and run their fingertips across the top of your fireplace mantle or your windowsill, and they would look at their fingers and see if they could see any dust. And if they did, they could exclude you. It was essentially a completely discretionary system where you could exclude someone for any reason, but you could sort of couch it under the good housekeeping test.
And then there were the midnight raids. This was in the days when only single mothers were eligible for welfare. Two-parent families didn't qualify, even if the father was unemployed or earning so little that the family was still poor. And to make sure a mother was really single, a squad of welfare workers would sometimes make surprise visits to recipients' houses.
After midnight, sometimes 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning.
Nancy Humphreys, the welfare worker, had colleagues. It was usually the men in the office who did these midnight raids.
You pounded on the door and you couldn't be denied entry. I mean, they would break the door down if necessary to get into the house.
If a man was found in the house, or just a man's belt, or razor, or large-sized shoe, the family could be kicked off welfare.
And often there were efforts to prosecute them for fraud, of having received benefits illegally.
All these rules, intermittently and subjectively enforced, had the effect of making the welfare system, as one civil rights leader at the time put it, a sieve with holes in it just big enough for the majority of Black families to fall through. Which brings us back to Ruby Duncan, the reluctant welfare recipient in Las Vegas, as she learned about the discrimination built into the welfare system.
I then began to hate the welfare system more. That's how I began to start organizing.
She saw it as an extension of the civil rights movement, the welfare rights movement.
Welfare rights was organizing women and making sure that all the different women throughout the community did not let the welfare department impose upon them.
Ruby and a handful of her friends started knocking on doors, finding other women on welfare.
We become stronger and stronger, women by the hundreds.
They worked with lawyers to file lawsuits against the welfare department, demanding equal rights and equal treatment for Black recipients and more job training for all recipients so they could find higher paying jobs. Or, in Ruby's case, a job that didn't require her to be on her feet all day. But there was resistance.
Then we all got together. I say we. I don't like saying I. Although I was the one that said, well, let's march on them.
And they stormed the welfare department.
Stay here and let this man know that you don't like what happened.
At the same time, similar welfare rights efforts in the street and in the courts were happening all over the country. This is a recording of a welfare rights gathering in Newark, New Jersey in 1967. And over the next few years, these organizing efforts worked. The white glove tests, the midnight raids, the man in the house rules were all thrown out or deemed unconstitutional. And in that time, something interesting happens. The number of people on cash welfare nearly triples.
So you see this sort of ballooning of welfare.
Here's sociologist Kathy Eden again.
In part, because this is a time in which people who are eligible actually claim their entitlement to cash aid. They were always out there, but they were excluded.
I've been thinking about that word Kathy Eden just said, entitlement, a lot lately.
Their entitlement to cash aid.
It's such an interesting and slippery word in the history of welfare. Today, the word entitlement has become synonymous with a sense of unearned privilege or selfishness. But entitlement also has this older, drier legal definition. A government program with benefits that aren't subject to budgetary discretion, that are entitled, written into law. And therefore, a government benefit that people who are eligible under that law have a claim to. In the late 60s and 70s, welfare rights activists like Ruby Duncan fought to gain access to that entitlement as a civil right, and the welfare rolls grew. And as they grew and had a much more diverse set of recipients, the whole welfare system got a lot more scrutiny.
We don't want to turn that safety net into a hammock.
We've taught people that you get paid off if you are helpless.
Today we are ending welfare as we know it. But I hope this day will be remembered not for what it ended, but for what it began.
You can hear the rest of that episode and also about how states now spend their welfare dollars. Download the Uncertain Hour podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This final note before we go today, there was a pretty big leave or remain vote right here in the U.S. earlier concerning basketball superstar Kevin Durant. He voted to leave his team, the Oklahoma City Thunder, for the Golden State Warriors. He'll join the Warriors All-Star lineup and two-time league MVP Steph Curry, creating what many are calling a super team. Now, the NBA had actually been trying to prevent super teams. New rules in 2011 tried to make the game more equitable for smaller market teams. But the NBA just raised the league salary cap $24 million per team because of a huge TV deal, and this year's Finals Game 7 was the highest-rated NBA game since 1998. So the league isn't likely to get that worked up over the whole equality issue. And yes, I am picking up on the meta overtones here. America. U.S. markets were closed today for the Independence Day holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Molly Wood. We'll be back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.